Hey listeners, for this episode, we want to give a major content warning for discussions of sexual assault and rape. Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly. And today, we're coming at you in our pajamas, basically, from Jessie's apartment, as usual, to talk about Girls of Paper and Fire by Natasha Nyan. The novel follows Lei, a young woman from a rural village who is captured and forced to join the ranks of the Paper Girls, the Demon King's harem of courtesans. Which in this case is just a euphemism for sex trafficking, listeners. Lei's defiance and strength grow over time, as does her attraction to Ren, another of the Paper Girls. Will Lei risk everything to defeat the Demon King? Spoilers. Yeah.
But also kind of no.
Yeah, also that.
Initial reactions. This book started out really exciting in the beginning, both because there is a lot of violence and things get really hectic all of a sudden, but then it slowed down the middle and then got really exciting again at the end. I'd definitely be willing to give a second book in the series a chance once it comes out, but it wasn't my favorite.
I wanted so badly to love this book, like so badly. And it just didn't land for me for a number of different reasons, like the pacing, the character development, the primary ship. I wanted so badly to love it, and it just didn't happen for me. There are things that I can appreciate and things that, you know, I thought weren't the best. So we'll get into that. But I don't know if I would read the second book. Maybe.
I kind of want to know what happens.
Yeah.
Is the problem. But I might also just Google it.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see how we feel.
Yeah. With some time in between.
Time to talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe.
This world building in this book is very thorough and well thought out. We get different parts of the world as Lei travels to the palace, as she is, you know, kidnapped to the palace. There seems to be lots of different kinds of clothing from different regions and different traditions and values. And I thought that was really cool to see, like, different types of Asian culture.
Absolutely. For me, the world building was one of the book's strongest qualities, especially when it was rooted in the present. Like, talking about the food, the clothes, the gardens, the other spaces, the smells. The prose was really sensory to me. I particularly noticed the smells and talking about the night blooming jasmine or the long long or the, I don't know, all the different like flower scents or all the different perfumes and that the paper girls have to wear. And I really liked that aspect. I thought that was really kind of evocative. For me, I wanted to know more of the, I wanted more of the like retroactive world building, like knowing more of the history of the land and how society was organized before, and then how the Night War changed things. And we get like hints of that throughout the novel, and we get a bit more of an info dump towards the end about the Night War and how that shifted social organization, basically. But I wanted more, so props to the author for drawing the reader in and for making me like really attached to what was happening in this world in the past, and then also props for the constructing that present in such a sensory way. What did you think?
I liked it in some aspects, but some of the things I just couldn't visualize very well. And I probably should have just looked some of those things up. While I liked the descriptions of the clothing, after a while it got to be too much for me. We get a description of like every outfit Lei is wearing. And I wasn't always sure what the clothing looked like, because we would get one description in the beginning and then they wouldn't. I don't really know how to explain. I don't know. For me, it was sometimes just too much.
I think that this, what you're saying, makes me think about how a lot of times white authors who are building fantasy worlds based off of like medieval Europe, mm-hmm. or something, can basically get away with lazy world building because it's so saturated in the cultural imaginary, at least in the Western cultural imaginary, about what that fantasy world looks like and what those outfits look like. But the Natasha Nyan can't do that, right?
So she mentions it once, and then I don't remember what something looks like. I think I would have...
Which might be why she goes back and describes more. Yeah. Because she knows that her readers, a lot of her readers, aren't going to be able to, aren't going to know what, like, a raccoon versus a Chengosama are.
Right. I think it would have been nice. Sometimes some books will, like, give you a glossary at the front of what things are, if it's, like, a lot of world building going on. So you could, like, go back, kind of like we get in Ruin and Rising with the different Grisha. I think I would have liked that for some of, like, the clothing, because I couldn't imagine what some of those things look like, except for, like, a sari, because I already knew what it was.
Right. So, like, a quick Google search, I guess, would probably help you out.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It would. I just don't want to do it. It takes me out of the world. And I think that sometimes that's hard for me when I'm reading.
But at the same time, if not just you, I'm not adding you specifically, but if readers, like...
At me.
But if readers like you and me who aren't familiar with Asian cultures, like, it makes sense that we'd have to do a little bit of homework.
Right.
Or, I mean, I guess it just depends on... It's not really fair, because I was invested and willing to do it for Children of Blood and Bone.
Right.
Which is, I mean, West African world that I'm not familiar with at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did. When I was reading that book, I would look up some of the things and what they looked like. Maybe because I didn't feel as much of a connection to the characters, I didn't feel the need to put in the time and effort.
Fair point,
which isn't really fair either of me to do. I don't know what I want.
Critiquing ourselves.
I know. There are also some things in the book where I wasn't sure... Because it's a made-up world, but there also seem to be different people from different regions, and I know that the author is Chinese. I wasn't sure if these are supposed to be, like, different regions of China or different regions of, like, Asian cultures collectively.
I think it's Asian culture more collectively because Natasha Nyan's part Chinese, maybe? I don't know if she's full Chinese.
I think she is part, right.
But she said she grew up in Malaysia. So that part, like the shadow puppets, that's a huge part of Malaysian culture.
Okay.
And then, which I only know because my parents lived there for a while when I was like three. And they, so, but then the saris are obviously a connection to, you know, Indian culture.
Right. Which is what I thought as well. And there were like darker skinned Asian people, not just like, I think what we see in media as like light skinned Asian people. So I don't know, like Chenna was, and I think she was the one wearing a sari as well.
Right.
So I thought I liked that, but I also wasn't sure like what the connections were supposed to be.
Yeah, there was some grafting on, it seemed like, of the fictional geography and culture, like the cultures that are associated with that geography, like in our world, to how that worked in the fictional world.
Right. I liked that.
Yeah, I appreciated that very much.
Wands out. This is a segment where we discuss all things magic. So we have shamans, part demon, part humans, and last surviving warriors. There are so many different kinds of magic in this world. I wasn't always 100% sure how all of it worked. Like, do the moon and steel cast have magical powers in addition to the shamans? And then I looked up a bunch of stuff on shamanism, which I will link in the notes later. It was just... There was a lot that I was unsure of.
Me too. That is the exact same thing I thought. I was wondering how it all works. The magic system in general. So there's mention that like magic and chi are connected. Mm-hmm. And if the chi's not in balance, then like it's like a misuse of magic, like on a moral and ethical level. And is what possibly is making the world sick. I think we would get more of that in future books. Are magic and chi the same? Are the spells, which are called Dao, I think, in the book, are they the only way to practice magic? Is there other sorts of like magic that you can do without Dao? Is someone born with an affinity to magic, like the Xia, like Ren's people? Or can anyone learn magic regardless of caste or bloodline? Is shaman synonymous with anyone who practices magic? Or are there other kinds? How are shamans recruited and trained? Many questions.
So many questions. And I actually looked up both Dao and shamanism, and the shamanism like connected to the story we were getting, and I didn't actually realize that like that shamanism had connections to Asian culture. That wasn't something I knew before, and I think it's something that I associate with African cultures. But the Tao, whatever I looked up, did not have any connection to the magic we get in this book. So I was also confused.
More for because we don't know the background.
Yeah, I just have no idea.
And also because I think I was wanting a little bit more explicit instruction as the reader,
right,
of how magic works in this world.
Definitely, because I also didn't know how the blessing pendant, like your birth pendant, worked, because it would like open after 18 years or whatever. And I was like, where do those come from? Like, what is that?
It's from a shaman who does a ritual at your birth.
Oh, what maybe did I you just forgot?
What did you think about that? About the birth pendants?
I thought it was kind of cool, but also I think I have stated before, like I don't really enjoy like the struggle between like determinism and free will. And so I don't really enjoy it when like a book gives you something that's like, this is your future. You can't change it. I don't know. That's just me. It's a weird thing that people often put in fantasy books.
Yeah, that's true. I thought the birth pendant was kind of a cool little nugget of like magic, right, to put in there. But I had a similar thought that at the same time, I don't like, is this really supposed to determine a person's fate?
Right.
Is it just like almost a placebo effect where I think it determines my fate? And so then I like make it so.
Also, it came up in the beginning and that's when we first learn about the birth pendant. But then it doesn't, like throughout the middle of the book, we don't really go back to it at all. So I also kind of forgot about it until the end of the book.
Yeah, I did too. And then they mention the birth pendant again, which is like somehow the one thing that she remembers to bring from her house, from right, the paper girl house.
Oh, because she like puts it on as she's getting ready to like go kill the king or assist in killing the king.
Right.
And I don't know, it just seemed like an afterthought almost, but.
And then it was flight. Her word was flight.
I didn't realize it was just going to be one word. I thought it was going to be like a prophecy.
No, it says it's one word.
Yeah, I just forgot. Which
you should have read closer at the beginning.
I know. Well, I read it in like a week, so I'm also surprised that I forgot so much while I was reading. But it happened.
It was just almost too tidy.
Right.
Flight because of Wren. Also, right, like Wren is literally a bird species.
Right. And they escape on a bird.
I have feelings about that. We'll talk about that later. I liked it, but at the same time, it didn't land, to use our flight terminology.
A little bit of turbulence.
A little bit of turbulence.
We get small snippets of folklore woven throughout, like the Barumi, which is the god of lost lovers, and Ling Yo, the goddess of impossible dreams. And I thought this expanded the world slowly in small pieces instead of getting an info dump. I know we get one at the end, but throughout the story, I did feel like we were being introduced to magic more through their religion, or I don't know, they're not really religious. Doesn't seem the same, but in their beliefs and like these higher powers.
Yeah, what you mentioned about religion is interesting. It struck me more as like spirituality because right, it didn't seem like an institution, like mm-hmm, a religious institution. The shamans to me don't seem particularly connected to like a religious institution.
Right.
But there definitely was the like shrines mm-hmm, for mourning your ancestors in the court of ghosts. And there is some connection to like a higher power and like discussions of chi. And it was interesting to see a world that didn't, very different from Ravka, for example,
right,
where you have the apparat who is the head of an institutional religion versus this much more radically democratic where people seem to have their own individual beliefs and have different gods or goddesses they pray to or have different shrines that they identify with based on regional affiliation.
Yeah, I liked that. I like when books have, like when fantasy books have some kind of like spiritual religious aspect, but it's not like strictly related to like Christianity. So we don't have like saints like we have in the Grishaverse. It's similar to Children of Blood and Bone.
Like, yes.
They have gods and goddesses. Maybe they don't associate with all of them, but we get to learn a little bit about them throughout the story. And I really liked that.
Yeah, I adored what you mentioned here about the folklore woven throughout. I adored that aspect of the book. I really thought that those were places where particularly the writing style like shone really brightly, being able to weave all of this throughout and make it like make sense and be relevant to what's happening like plot wise. I really liked that aspect.
Agreed. The people of the Moon and Steelcast seem to take on some of the personality traits associated with the animals they resemble. And I really liked that a lot. Like Tien, they call her fussy because she's kind of like a cat and she's like very clean. Or General Yu is like stubborn and like trying to get his way because he's a bull. And I really thought that was really cool.
I like that part too.
Yeah. I like animals. So I just thought that was neat.
I had a hard time imagining what they looked like.
Oh, me too.
Sometimes the moon cast specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And the steel cast, like how can, is one just, the moon cast is more explicitly like overtly animal looking versus the steel cast. Maybe you just have like some scales.
That's what it seemed like. Like maybe you just had a small amount of animal features. But I did sometimes, especially with the people who resembled birds, like Madame
Humira.
Yeah, I had a hard time imagining what a person would look like with a beak on their face and like eagle eyes. That was hard to imagine for me. And I don't think it was from lack of description. It just,
no,
so different than what we normally get in books.
Exactly.
And written media.
Yeah. And then that also makes me think about how kind of curious it is that then we're supposed, the descriptions of people as handsome or beautiful, but
right,
they're mainly animal.
Right.
That was kind of surprising to me. And I was like, oh.
I think I just imagine them kind of like cartoons, like the Fantastic Mr. Fox. Like they're like animals walking upright. That's what I imagine them looking like animated, almost like stop motion clay characters, which is kind of strange and weird,
but I can see it.
Yeah,
I see that for sure.
Yeah.
Wands away. Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in a segment called Get Me Kylo Ren.
So when General Yu kills Bao, I about lost it. That's when I was like, this book is going to be over the top violent, and it wasn't as violent as I thought it would be, I should say. I was furious. I like had to put the book down because I was like, and I don't even like dogs that much. And I just could not handle that.
It reminded me of watching John Wick for the first time. Spoiler alert, the puppy gets killed. Oh my God, that was awful. Yeah, that was a rough part of the book. That was the roughest part of the book.
Yeah. But I thought it was strange because we don't really get more of General Yu until the very end.
Yeah, he disappears and then comes back.
I was surprised. I thought we would see more of him throughout, like kind of like he was like a mental presence for Lei, as far as she didn't want to make mistakes or really screw it up because of what he said about killing her family, basically. But he wasn't like a physical presence, and that was really surprising. I just thought we'd get more of him.
Yeah, that's true. General Yu is sort of emblematic of the way that violence works and like power works in this book. About, he's this figure that he comes in and just basically kidnaps someone that he wants and doesn't really care about the collateral damage. He'll kill her pet dog. He doesn't give a shit. And it seems to be that's how violence works throughout the book, with this like raid dynamic where no village is safe because they might possibly be like set upon by the state and like state sanctioned violence, essentially.
Yeah, you would think that the villages would start arming themselves or something. I don't know, maybe it's impossible, but I guess because they're the weakest of the cast, because most of them are humans or the paper cast. But yeah, I don't know. It's not like we saw any raids, so I don't know how terrible it is, but it was just, I don't know. Yeah.
There was just a suggestion of it. We didn't really see anything besides when Lei is captured at the beginning.
And as they're like going to the palace, they do see a burned out village, but they're also blaming that on the sickness, which I'm not even sure if it's a real thing or not, or if it's something the king has made up.
yeah, I kind of get the sense that it is, and that'll be a bigger, that the book series as a series is going to like get more into that macro sphere of what is the sickness about, what is like it, what does it mean that the chi of the entire world is out of balance because of the demon king using an army of shamans or something.
That
is
my assumption, that he's using too much magic, because it seems like there's 1 hour a year where the shaman aren't using magic to protect the palace. So my guess is that is what's causing the sickness.
I have no idea. Like, I don't know. What is he even using magic for? Is it just to be violent? Because it seems like he has troops to do that too.
That, but also like when they're going to the palace, General Yu mentions how no one would be able to get through like the woods without the shaman letting them in. So I think it's also as a way to like isolate himself and protect the palace. I don't know. So I think the shaman are always doing work to like protect the king in some way.
It'd be a really boring job.
It would be super boring.
You just get to maintain a wall.
Walls are not good. We don't need them.
No, thanks.
The king, the demon king, is a villain we don't actually get to know that well, which was weird.
I think in the book, we're more just told that he's bad.
Yeah.
And then we do see, obviously, like, he's awful and violent and, like, an abuser and a rapist.
Yes.
And then we kind of get snippets of his past, but just very briefly, when he talks to Lei the first time and talks about how he doesn't even have a name and how he had to kill his brothers. But the not having a name part really brought my, like, that, I don't know why that brought, that like came to my attention as being something significant, that maybe he like is acting the way he is in order to like fill these enormous hooves, shall we say, that is like this position rather than just being a person, by which I mean being, because I don't know if you would call them people. Sure, you can call them people.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe if he had a name, he wouldn't be as awful, because he'd have some sort of identity beyond just trying to perform this sort of power.
But I assume the first Demon King had a name.
Right. But then they changed. And then he stopped having a name.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of fantasy novels put a sense of importance on names. And we see it a lot in like fairy books with true names. Yeah, it's weird that he doesn't have a name. And he's talking to Lei about it, but then doesn't like give himself. Like, why don't you just give yourself a name? I would just name myself, you know? Is that important to you?
Just pick one.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to pick Jesse because it's great. I really like it.
I'm going to pick Kelly because it's the only one I've ever had, and I haven't really thought about it.
So the king was a strange villain. We don't get to know him very well. I don't know.
I don't know if I want to know him very well, but at the same time, I think it would have been more effective in like crafting the tension in the novel.
It's one of the things I didn't like about The Darkling is that we didn't get that much information about his past or about him. So I was kind of like, meh, whatever.
that's like,
which is the opposite for you, obviously.
Funny that you should say that, because yeah, we have similarly less. We don't know that much about the Darkling either, but I have way more feelings about him.
Yeah,
I do with the Demon King.
Probably because there are positive emotions associated with the Darkling for Alina, at least at first. And for Lei, all of her thoughts and feelings about the Demon King are he's a terrible person, creature, whatever, and I don't want to have sex with him, and he's going to force me to have sex with him. That's like, and he killed my mom and my dog.
But he didn't kill her mom and the dog.
Yeah, but
he
like
ordered his like minions did it.
Yeah, but it's his fault ultimately.
Sure,
I would kill him too. I would John Wick his ass.
Oh my god, for sure. Jesse, you know that one does not simply walk into Mordor. And similarly, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. Before we talk about the caste system or gender dynamics or anything like that, I wanted to talk about something that stuck out to me during the execution scene when the rebels are getting executed. So before the three captured resistance fighters are killed, The king says the following. This is a quote. When an attack like the one masterminded by these anarchists occurs, it is an affront to our unity, to the world we have built so tirelessly over these past two centuries with our blood and sweat and tears and hope. And we must come together in that very unity to bring down those who try to destroy us. End quote. That's on page 267. So what the king is doing here is telling a story that legitimizes the oppressive government and unjust rule, while also at the same time delegitimizing those who have every reason to object to such power structures and who work to dismantle them. And the reader has access to this counter narrative of the resistance. We see the paper cast up close and personal. We see the oppression, we see the violence and how awful it is. But the average citizen in the fictional world doesn't have access to that counter narrative. So this just really stuck out to me, that the ability to shape narrative and to dole out legitimacy in whatever ways will help maintain the established power structure is one of the state, and not like the state, any state, like any nation state's greatest weapons. So I don't know if you had feelings about that or if you thought about that at all.
I had not thought about it at all. It's funny because I was watching this English talk show. Not really a talk show, but like a political commentary show this morning, and they were talking about how when the doctors were striking, there was a person in government who said that they were striking because they were greedy, but really what was happening was that the doctors were not getting paid adequately for what they were doing. So there was a doctor who wrote a book about his like 7 years as a junior doctor. I don't even know what a junior doctor is, but apparently that's a thing in England. But kind of to like change the narrative to show, like, because the average person doesn't always have access to all the facts, and how it's the government's responsibility to really give them those facts, but they can really spin them to mean whatever they want. And it really causes a lot of problems when they change the facts to like support their narrative, which is something we see now as well.
Right. And the state, because it is the state, like with a capital S, has the, for the average citizen, the assumption is credibility.
Right.
And legitimacy.
Right.
When in reality, the stories you're telling, for example, that like glorify the United States as like a melting pot and a nation of immigrants, ignore the fact that it was founded upon like the genocide that settler colonialism requires. And then also fucking slavery.
Yeah. Built on the backs of Black people.
Literally.
Yeah.
So this sort of, it just really stuck out to me that that this is what governments do all the time, is they change how the narrative is given to average people, and in that way shore up their own power.
Right. And we see that now when people talk about Middle Eastern people being terrorists and bad people, when really you're more likely to die at the hands of another American on a day-to-day basis than you are from a terrorist attack. Like,
cis, het, white, dude.
Yeah. Don't trust your government. Don't believe what they tell you. They're probably lying to you.
Yeah. And at the same time, the government's obviously not going to give its citizens the tools to overthrow it or to like hold it to a higher standard, really.
No.
Because then people are just gonna like come at you for like quote unquote complaining.
Right.
This is getting, can you tell it's personal? Can you tell? May or may not have felt this way in my own life. So that, I don't know, that part of the narrative really brought to my attention those sorts of power dynamics and how the state like manipulates information and stories. And but at the same time, it's spun as like objective truth, which is not true.
No.
And along those same lines, the state also has the power to determine who its citizens can mourn. And this has crucial implications for which lives matter. And that is like, I use that language on purpose, right? So in the novel, Ren isn't allowed to grieve her birth family because she's part of the Xia, who are the demon kings have systematically exterminated in like a genocide campaign, or they're not able to mourn the executed resistance fighters. And this part of the novel made me think about state sanctioned mourning, like in the US, for example, because that's like the case that I know best. So the flags are at half staff for George H.W. Bush for the entire month of December 2018. But there's no state sanctioned mourning for people like Yaclyn Calmaquin, the 7-year-old Guatemalan girl who died in Border Patrol custody. And But like, wait for it. Guess why? Jacqueline and her father, who are Guatemalan, are coming up with like a wave of migration up from Central America to our southern border in the United States. And guess why that happened? Oh, wait, it's because of American interventionism through like after the First World War, particularly, and CIA involvement in murdering democratically elected leaders from Central America whose policies conflicted with American economic and political interests. And guess who's a prime example of American interventionism? George H.W. Bush. He was involved in the CIA for years. He was VP under Reagan, and the Reagan administration committed some of the worst atrocities in Central America. Like it's just fucking wild. And that's all before H.W. was even the president. So anyway, out of breath, all worked up. Other people have said this better than me, so and with immense detail, so check out the show notes for more. But like the state tells can like literally cue who you should care about by creating, by giving certain people visibility for mourning and other people not.
Well, it's in their best interest. Our presidents are supposed to be held to a higher standard, and they're supposed to be seen as like, I don't even know, like, I want to say like kings, because we've only had all male presidents, but they're seen as like above everyone else. I didn't even realize his flags were at half mast until the other day, and I was like, what the fuck's going on? Like, why is that?
Yeah, like, for the entire month.
It's ridiculous, especially when like, when you think about the things that George H.W. Bush did, he wasn't a good president. He's a terrible person. I don't have to mourn someone just because they were the president, especially not some white dude. Yeah. I will only mourn Barack.
Forever our president.
Yeah.
Though he did some fucked up shit too.
Oh yeah. But, they all do.
Oh yeah. Absolute power corrupts, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think Natasha Nyan's novel really is in dialogue with these sorts of kind of more subtle ways that the state exercises power in order to maintain its own power. And it reinforces like its legitimacy with these different, like I said, subtle ways that perhaps we're not thinking about all the time as citizens.
Right. And I wonder if it's something that someone, like if her family grew up in China and she grew up in Malaysia, maybe think about more, because sometimes, or at least in America, we see the Chinese government as more obvious, like having more obvious control over their people, or attempting to have control over their people in different ways than we see in America, like by, you know, having control over like what they see on the internet, those sorts of things. So I wonder if you think about that more when you're from a group of people who seem more obviously oppressed. I don't know.
That's a good question. I guess I don't really know how these, I'm obviously comparing it to the U.S. context because that's right. What I know, and mm-hmm. I probably should look up more about the other contexts.
Right. Most of what I know about China is from like the news, trusted news sources. I trust NPR.
100% neutral, totally objective. That's yeah. Sarcasm.
Yeah, I know. But trustworthy adjacent.
Let's talk about race.
We have all Asian characters and no white characters.
Yay.
I know. I think part of the reason I really wanted to like this book, and that sometimes, oh, you know, there's a really good code switch about the rep sweats, about like the fear you have and like about needing to like something because it's representative of a culture, and how that can like put a lot of pressure on something to be good. We'll link to it in the show notes because it was a really good episode.
I have to listen to that episode.
Yeah, it's great. But part of the reason I really wanted to like this book is because like it has representation, not for me, but for other people. And I was like, this is going to be great. I'm going to love it. And part of me wonders a little bit if I put too much pressure on myself to like the book because it included representation.
I think I totally did.
Because it wasn't a bad book.
No, not at all.
I'd give it 3 out of 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
I did on Goodreads. but I think that sometimes there's like more pressure because it's written by an underrepresented group to be better, to be twice as good, in the words of Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I was glad to have you know, an all Asian cast of characters, and it was great. It was
absolutely
beautiful.
Absolutely.
White people don't have to be in everything. Sorry, Kelly.
Not sorry. Sorry, not sorry.
No, I'm not sorry at all. So it was interesting to me that Lei's mother tells her that all the castes are the same deep down. I thought of this as similar to people who say that they don't see race, which belittles the suffering those seen as lesser experience at the hands of those with privilege and power. I didn't really appreciate that. And I don't think Lei feels that the same as her mother in the end. But coming from the like group that is experiencing the most suffering, I thought it was weird to be like, we don't see castes, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to, I guess there doesn't have to be a balance necessarily, but to see the humanity, for lack of a better term, because I know there's like animality or whatever, you know what I mean,
right?
The humanity, for lack of a better word, in all of these beings, regardless of their outward, like their phenotypes,
right?
Which is what race is. It's just a phenotype. But at the same time, those phenotypes now are coded socially.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't exist in a vacuum.
Right.
As far as like how you are outwardly represented to the world and how the other, you have no control how the world reads you and how you fit within those power structures.
Right.
Because they existed before you. And I get the impulse. I understand the impulse and think that that's good, like a good moral, ethical impulse. But at the same time, I 100% agree with you about that's not how this world works or our world works.
Right.
And so I guess like you're teaching your child to be tolerant with this sort of a lesson, but at the same time, like not legitimizing or like validating the rage and the like deep grief of being the most oppressed caste.
Right. It was surprising to me because we also see Lei like dealing with her prejudice. Obviously, I don't even know what you would call it. She's not racist.
Bias.
She has like bias towards the other castes, but it's one of those instances where I'm like, yeah, I get it. When you are the lesser class of citizen, of course you think those above you, like you have like negative connotations with them because they've always treated you badly. But it's a good representation of how like if you are the one without power, like you're not the one, like your bias doesn't really do anything.
It's not oppressive.
No. And it can't be. Yeah.
And like how racism against white people doesn't exist.
Oh, no, it does not.
It is not a thing.
It doesn't exist. Yeah.
The moon cast and slash demons, like they're the more full demon. They're called full demons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that superiority argument is completely unfounded. We don't even get any access to why the paper castes are seen as lesser than. We just see their constant oppression and abuse. It's like the circular reasoning that has no foundation, which I thought was great because that's how any argument for racial superiority is bullshit and baseless. And yet they lead to systems of oppression that can seem really impossible to topple. And they seem like really unimpeachable, but they're not. They're just based upon no logic whatsoever. Or like faulty logic, I would say.
Right. Yeah. Unsound logic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. And it was interesting because we did get to see some of the cast interacting with each other. But we don't, I guess we don't see Lei interacting with any full demons, do we?
At the end.
Is that Wolf
the
guy?
Wolf one.
Okay, I couldn't remember.
His name starts with a K.
Kenzo? It must be right. We both guessed that.
Yeah.
I also thought it was interesting that the steel cast, no, the moon cast, like they're associated with demons. I guess both of them. That was weird. Because we don't really get much talk about the devil in this story.
But I don't think the demons in this world are necessarily associated with the devil.
No, I don't think they are either. It was just like,
they're just non-human beings.
Right. It was just interesting to me because I think maybe because I grew up in a Christian household that demons are so closely associated with the devil that I was like, wait, what? But we don't get no mention of like the highest of high of the demons, you know?
Yeah, I think that that's where you're coming from.
Yeah,
that sounds like really, that sounds really on point, because what I was thinking of is that in Chinese culture, for example, you have the different years that are associated with different animals. Mm-hmm. So like the actual presence of animals is a lot more important. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of more the demon lineage that the book is in dialogue with.
That makes sense.
I'm just guessing. I don't know.
I mean, it sounds right. So I'm just going to be like, all right, that's fine.
But please correct me if I'm wrong. Anyone out there in the ether listening?
Yeah. Lei is afraid slash nervous when around a lot of steel and moon cast people. And I saw this as similar to the way POCs feel in a crowd of white people.
Yep. White people are the most dangerous.
Oh my God. They are murderers. They are rapists. They are some bad people.
We'll spin that 45th logic.
Hashtag not my president. Yeah,
for real.
All right. Let's talk about class. There is a literal caste system going on in this book that is based on the way people look, which is obviously intersected with our thoughts about race.
Mm-hmm.
And being human relegates you a person to the lowest class, which was different.
Yeah. It kind of upends what you would, this typical, like, the more animal, the lower, like, animalization as a way of dehumanizing, as in, like, making them lower.
Right.
And less important. And that is completely flipped on its head in this novel, which I liked, that it was different. And this caste system that you're mentioning grafts onto the economic and political systems, right? So the people who wield the most political power and the people who have the most prestigious jobs and have the most money are of the highest caste, so the demon caste, and then steel is in the middle, and then human, like the paper caste, is made to do all the grunt work, basically.
Right. I guess it makes sense when we, in today's times, like humans are at the like top of the food chain, but only because we have like weapons that can kill animals that would kill us without them. So it kind of makes sense that the demon caste would be at the top, because they could just kill all the paper castes like without weapons at all. Like when we see Naja and Kenzo fighting, like it's very animalistic. And if we were just like out in the wild, animals would kill us for sure.
For sure.
That's why I stay inside.
Stay inside and read.
Yeah, read and knit. Read and knit.
Read and knit. All day. Gender.
Let's talk about gender. Are the shaman only men?
We didn't really even see individualized shaman.
Maybe they're genderless.
It'd be cool if there were this, like, I don't know.
Like non-binary.
Non-binary, or maybe like an intersex group of people, like just not like fitting into the traditional hierarchy, I guess, of gender and sex.
The first shaman we see about when she's talking about the birth pendant, when Lei mentions she calls the shaman he. And at first I was like, oh, all the shaman are men. That's some bullshit. Mm-hmm. But then as we went on, we didn't get any single individual shaman, so I wasn't sure. Maybe there's no nothing.
It's a very patriarchal society,
mm-hmm.
which is the thing I like want to talk about next. So mm-hmm. it wouldn't surprise me if all the shaman were men, but I don't think we explicitly like get told one way or the other.
Right.
The society is so bigoted, so patriarchal. It was rough to read some of the time, honestly. Like some of the rhetoric about women and about what they mean and what they're worth. Like, oh, that was rough.
Yeah, not a fan of patriarchal societies. Fuck that.
No thanks.
Yeah, kill the king.
Thank you, next.
Thank you, next.
And then something else that came up for me was that Madame Humira, right? Humira?
All I can think of is Humira, like the medicine.
Like the medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all I could. Every time I saw it, I was like, this is so close to Humira. And I know it's in my mind because like I take it, but I was just like, Humira? Humira's the name? Right. I don't know.
Anyway, the like eagle lady, demon, moon cast person is an example of how women can be some of patriarchy's staunchest supporters.
Yes.
Like literally physically abusive, emotionally abusive, in order to uphold this patriarchal structure that the paper girls need to be held to the super high standard so the king can just like use them and throw them away after a year.
It is surprising. We don't often see, or I haven't often seen in stories, women being the like parental figure who is abusive. And Madame Humira is like that person.
Gave me some serious Aunt Lydia vibes, like from the Handmaid's
Tale. Oh, yeah,
I
forgot about Aunt Lydia. I gave up on that show, so.
From the, I'm thinking of the book.
Okay, I didn't read the book.
I didn't watch the show. Bodies.
I think we have maybe some differing opinions here.
I think we might.
And it's okay. So I was thinking of Aoki versus Lei as a like model of prostitution versus sex slavery. And I want to talk about that.
What would you like to... Do you want me to go? Do you want to go?
Let me let you go.
Okay. I would say it's all sex slavery because I'm not sure that we can say any of the characters consented to be paper girls, like of their own volition. Aoki, even. Like she's, you know, doesn't. I think that the notion of consent as being possible in this situation is very dubious for me. And there's always other factors involved, like the king providing for the families of the lower caste girls, which is Aoki's, what happened to her, or the girl's parents making the decision for them, like Blue. And maybe we can consider people working at the night houses as like sex workers, so people who are like doing consensual sex work.
Right.
But that might still be sex slavery / sex trafficking, at least for the people who didn't choose to be there. Like for if you're a paper girl and then your year's up and then you're just like put somewhere else.
Right.
And then Aoki strikes. So I'll leave it there. What do you think?
Okay.
After I
said that. The problem for me is obviously in the beginning, I was like, this is all sex slavery and this is terrible. Like what? I don't even have the words to describe like what the fuck is going on in this system right now. Like, what are you guys doing? Like, what's going on? But then Aoki decides that she's in love with the king and she wants to be a paper girl. And I don't want to say she's too young to make that decision because she's like 16, which to me feels too young. But like in other countries, you're an adult and like that's fine. But I don't know if she also just like has like Stockholm syndrome, you know?
That's exactly what I was thinking like, too.
At what point does it become your decision versus like you have been like mentally boxed in to thinking that this is correct, even though it's not? I don't know.
Right. Is it the sort of Stockholm? I had the same questions. Is it the sort of Stockholm syndrome situation, like infatuation with her abuser?
Right.
But does thinking that and saying that like blanket statement, that's how it is that taking away a woman's agency?
Exactly.
And by like not trusting her when she says she's in love with the king?
Right.
I don't know. I'm super conflicted about this.
Me too.
I don't have a resolution, I don't think.
I don't think I do either, but I wanted to talk about that. I don't know. Yeah.
It's like how can Belle really be in love with the Beast? Like, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, Tamlin.
Tamlin. Oh my God.
Spoilers. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if she can. And I don't know at what point do we decide something is Stockholm syndrome versus your choice, you know?
Is it a choice if you don't have any other choices?
Right, exactly. Because Aoki doesn't. And she starts to think that the Demon King will make her his queen, even though we already know that paper caste people cannot become the queen.
Is it a way of not being traumatized anymore? Is it like a coping mechanism?
Probably in some way. I thought of people who, like in TV shows or in real life, I'm sure it happens in real life too, who think like they're the other person in a relationship that's not an open relationship. And they're like, they're going to leave them and marry me. And I'm like, that's never going to happen. Like, that doesn't happen in real life. Okay, it probably does. But you know what I mean? That's what I was thinking. Like, she has created this narrative in her head that he's going to leave the current demon queen and pick me, a paper caste, to be the queen and like birth his heir or whatever.
I don't have any answers.
But either.
Speaking of demon queen, speaking of another sex slave,
Oh. She
just like, I don't know, is she just like locked up in a basement?
I'm not even 100% sure if she actually exists. I don't know. We don't see her.
We don't see her ever, but it made the story leads us to think that the demon queens only exist for procreation.
Ugh, yeah.
Which is then, like, once... Okay, so the demon queen only gets value because of procreation. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, for the sex workers at the night houses, once they have a baby, they no longer have any value in the, like... sex work trade,
right?
Like, they can't be sex workers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm just taking that from what that's what Zelly, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, says happened to her mother,
right?
So she never met her mother, and mm-hmm. then her mother was, quote, given as a gift to another dude. So, like, then you have to, then you're sex trafficked,
right? Yeah.
I just, like, fuck.
Yeah,
no, women can't win in this situation.
No. There was a lot of sexual assault in this book, and I was glad the author didn't get into, like, the nitty-gritty of, like, when the Demon King did rape Lei, but I was also, like, that was hard to read. I can't imagine experiencing that in real life.
Speaking of that, the book actually has a content warning.
Yeah.
In the beginning, like, right before the foreword, and that was the first time I'd ever seen anything like that happen in a book.
No, I don't think I have either. And at the end... in the author's note, Natasha talks about how she was sexually assaulted, and she doesn't go into detail, but she does also give resources for people who have been victims of sexual assault and rape at the end, and says that she, like, hopes this story helps you realize, like, that you have strength even when, like, someone tries to break you. And I thought that was a great thing to add to the end of the book. Mm-hmm. And I'm a person who doesn't always read the author's note, but...
like, yielding, not breaking.
Yeah.
Hannah Gadsby and Nanette talks about that. Mm. Which is, like, that blew me wide open. I, like, wept.
I haven't watched it yet.
It's so good.
It's on my list.
Oh, yeah. There was so much sexual assault in this book. And that was... Even if it didn't, like, get explicitly shown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, more of the physical abuse was shown,
right,
versus the sexual abuse. And I thought that it was fine that didn't get, like, fleshed out. I don't know. That's just, like, reliving people's, like, I don't know. I don't know if there's really a point to putting that sort of trauma on the page in this particular novel anyway.
No.
But it was even the suggestion of it. Like, you're just living with the presence of it. That's what being a paper girl is.
Right.
Like, that is their what their existence consists of.
Agreed. Yeah.
Oof.
It was a lot.
It was.
You kind of, like, hinted about this already. So on page 266, Lei says, because what is a king without an heir? And on page 265, Ren is talking and she says, until she gives the king a male heir, Ren replies, she's pretty much insignificant, which feeds into this terrible notion that a person only has worth if they produce children. And I was interested to see that they put that on the king as well and not just on the demon queen, even though we don't see her and she's, like, almost a non-existent character in the book. I feel like in today's society, most of that blame of not being able to, like, produce a child goes on the woman and feeds into this notion that, like, women aren't valuable members of society if they don't have children, which is bullshit. Not everyone wants kids.
Mm-hmm. And also in our current reality, that's a lie that is particularly tied up in capitalism.
Oh, for
because
sure.
You're a better consumer under a capitalist system if you create more babies, so
right,
that they can then become future, so you can, like, consume materials, giving them to them and growing them up, and
right,
then you're producing like a lineage of consumers, basically.
Yeah, for sure.
And workers.
Yeah,
people to be exploited.
Maybe they don't want that. Never mind that it's bad for the environment to have more kids.
We don't need
any more of them. Cats, no. Not kids.
Cats not kids.
Or dogs in Kelly's
case. I've never heard that.
I say it all the time.
It's your mantra.
I don't want children. I just want lots of cats.
I support great. You.
Thank you.
I support you.
You're great. Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about sexuality, asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own. Lesbian characters.
Yay!
I was really excited. I think this is our first book with main characters that are queer.
Yeah, you're right.
We're always getting side characters.
That's not a minisode, because we talked about Ship It.
Oh yeah, Ship It was great. I love Ship It.
So but yeah, you're totally right. This is the first non-hetero main ship.
Yeah, And I was glad for that.
Absolutely.
So glad. I thought it was really strange, though, talking about queerness, that in a society that seems to be accepting of homosexuality in men, but they're not in women, are women not allowed to have pleasure in sex? Which you don't have to have sex to be queer. Like, that's not important. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a lot of slut shaming in a story where the king is having sex with all the paper girls, the demon queen, and probably other people. It was just all around strange.
Very sex negative society.
Yeah.
That only, but then like uses sex for the paper girls, like exploits certain people for sex specifically, but doesn't let those people have any agency. It's only like state sanctioned.
It seemed like the book was only like the society was only interested in like men having sex and enjoying sex, but women don't have sex, and when they do, they don't like it. It was strange.
Yeah. There was so much slut shaming, and it really, to me, it's just another facet of how the patriarchy works.
Right. But it was weird too, because like you see Blue being like kind of shitty to some of the other girls for also having sex. So, but I'm like, you guys are all having sex with the same dude. Like what, like why were you giving them a hard time about it when it's not like they have a choice, you know?
Right.
I just thought it was strange. She was real shitty.
Yeah, she was. Also, I think we should mention that this book definitely goes along like the gender binary. There don't seem to be any gender nonconforming like queer people who don't identify as either, you know, masculine or feminine. Mm-hmm. So the society is very binary. And mm-hmm. so like kind of like our society right now, at least in the over narrative
for most people. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that Lei and Ren formed a bond so quickly and with like very limited interaction that it was difficult to feel connection with them. Like I didn't ship them.
Neither did I. The ship never left shore. Not even close. Like it didn't even finish construction at the shipyard. Like I need to stop right now with this metaphor. But I wasn't feeling the tension or the connection between the characters. And this was one of the most like, maybe I just am disappointed in myself for not feeling it. Maybe it was there and it would, I just didn't have access to it personally as a reader. But it just, I desperately wanted to feel it. I really did.
Me too.
And I just didn't.
You know, I don't think I really like those like instant love stories as part of it because like me personally, I don't believe in like love at first sight or whatever. So I was just kind of like, what do you mean you like this girl already? You don't even know her. She's just pretty. Like that's so like surface level bullshit. Like get to know someone before you're like, I love them.
Also because there's no mention of Lei waking up to sexuality in general.
Right.
It just seems to be connected specifically to Ren, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But then I guess it was like another hurdle,
right,
to then craft the tension,
right,
on a story level.
Yeah, because we don't see her like having feelings for like some girl in her village or some guy in her village. I don't know. Like for anyone else, she doesn't have feelings like romantic feelings for anyone else before this. I think she maybe she does mention a boy.
I don't think so. I don't remember that.
Oh, now I don't remember.
Maybe I'm just not remembering. Maybe she does.
Now I don't know if it was something else I was reading. Sexy times. We don't really get sexy times. There are not any positive descriptions of sex. Lei and Ren do a lot of kissing and maybe like cuddling, and that's all we get.
This was one of my biggest issues, I would say, with the book. And to me, the book missed several chances to give positive depictions of non-hetero sex. So in the yay lessons, like or ye, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, lessons with the courtesan Zelly, for example, those would have been a great time to do some sort of like anatomy lesson or IDK, like mention what the clitoris is. But the scenes with Ren and Lei, like dot dot dot, I don't like, I just have to come out and say it. Do they actually fuck?
I don't think so.
Are they snuggling and fucking or both? Like
just like couldn't with the quote heat in my core and the quote like disappearing into each other's arms business. Like, that's fine in conjunction with like a little bit more of an exploration of what right. sex is and sexuality and what those feelings are like, I would say. And I guess I just was really hoping for more visibility of non-hetero sex.
Right.
And by which I mean like actual sex, not the suggestion of sex. And I mean, plenty of YA books do this, like they do the fade out or, but I just like, I don't know. I was wanting the scenes to be hotter, I guess. Not necessarily explicit. That's not, I'm not talking, I don't need like Moss levels of, Sarah J. Maas levels of like sex.
Not always.
Not always. Sometimes it's great. But I don't know. I guess like even the like sex adjacent interactions, physical interactions, just like fell short for me, I guess. And I like, I wanted that, like the greater visibility of non-heterosex. I wanted that in this book because the book seems kind of ready to display sexual trauma and like to put that everywhere, but not sexual pleasure.
Right.
And yet at the same time, Leigh and Ren are saying things about their love being true resistance.
Right.
And their like relationship. And that's like being a choice that really is emblematic of how much they're like saying fuck you to right. the like overarching structure. And I absolutely agree, it is resistance, especially in like a particularly lesbian phobic culture, and against the norms of the paper girls who are only supposed to exist for the king's consumption. So it is resistance, and I was just hoping for like a little bit more of exploration, like exploration of what that actually meant. What do you think?
I think I would have been like more on board with it, because if there had been a fade out, but there wasn't a fade out, they're just like, I just assume they were cuddling, and there's no talk of them like being asexual and not wanting to have sex with each other.
Which is also fine.
Yeah, but Leigh is obviously like feeling sexual urges, and I don't know that, I would assume Ren is as well. But
or even like masturbation?
Yeah, like literally anything, but they're just like sitting in a bathtub together kissing, or like whatever other thing, euphemisms they use for cuddling. I don't know. I was like, y'all are just making out all the time. I don't know.
Right. But also there was a suggestion that they did more than that. I don't really, or maybe I'm like projecting that. I don't know. And I'm wondering, like, off of your comment earlier, like, am I holding this book to a higher standard when it comes to sex and romance specifically because mm-hmm. of, you know, its representation?
Right.
Because it's more representative of other identities that you don't usually get to be in the spotlight.
Right.
And like, I guess maybe, but at the same time, I can't help thinking, because there are so few YA books with LGBTQIA plus protagonists and ships, that unfortunately books like this bear the burden of responsibility.
Right.
And it's like too great of a burden. It shouldn't have to exist, but right. it does at the same time. So like, I don't really know how to reconcile those two things. And especially because a young person could encounter this book and might be a venue for them to think about their own sexuality. So I think it was like a yes, but like a good but
right.
for me.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's not exactly like at the same, it's not doing the same thing as other YA books. Like, the insinuations of sex are much more visible in other YA books. Like, even when we read What If It's Us, or right. Now I can't think of anything else we've ever read. Reaper at the Gates, like all the books, like the insinuations of sex are so much more strong than the ones in these books. And we do get fade outs. We haven't read anything with like actual
sex scene,
but this book just like didn't even give me the feeling that they were having sex. I was just like, okay, I guess you're not going to show that. Or if you want to make them asexual, like just make them asexual. That
right,
would
that's
be good
totally
too.
Fine too. They can be homoromantic and asexual.
Yeah. Like that would
that's
be
awesome.
Great. We haven't read that either.
Right.
But like, say it. I think that's my problem. I'm like, just say it. Like, what are they doing? What are they not doing?
And I do want to like then couch this in terms of, I am so glad that the author made the choice to have two women fall in love.
Yes. And two women of color. Like, yes. We don't get depictions of that very often. It's usually white women. We get a lot of white ladies.
I'd also like to see just putting this out there, like a dynamic where like an actual butch lesbian gets some some representation, yeah, right? Because there's a lot of the very feminine of center, mm-hmm, lesbians who are allowed to, you know, have their love be on display.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Why don't we have that?
I don't know. I think it's media representation in general. It's not, yeah, just, it's not just books, and it's definitely not just YA.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all the things.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings.
So some of the descriptions were so detailed that it really slowed down the pacing for me. I didn't need a description of Ren's eye color every time Ren and Lei met eyes. A description of every meal. I know you liked it, apparently. But I was just like, man, I don't need to know everything you're eating. I don't need to know, like, what kind of brown Ren's eyes are. I get it, they're brown. It just slowed it down for
Ren's
me.
Ren's eyes were blue. Lei's eyes were gold.
Okay, well, whatever it was. Now I don't remember. I thought I remember her describing. Okay, now I'm confused.
Oh, no, maybe they were brown. Ren's eyes were brown. I don't know.
Maybe I'm just assuming they're brown because she's Asian. That's on me. But either way, it was too much. Too much for me.
George R. R. Martin does that. And, like, takes a lot of pause to describe all the food. Mm. And I remember my partner saying that that's a big part of Redwall, which is a series I never read.
Oh, I was like, I don't know what that is.
Non-human. It's all the animals.
Yeah. Okay. I've seen them at the library.
But apparently there are a lot of like really vivid descriptions of food. I think it's like either a thing you're into as a reader or that you could like take it or leave it.
It's hard for me because sometimes I start skipping over it, like just skimming it. And then I miss something important that's actually important. So I get annoyed. I also don't like George R. R. Martin. I hate his writing. Sorry, not sorry.
I didn't finish the second book.
I only read the first one. I was like, Game of Thrones TV show, great. Game of Thrones books, trash.
It's been a while since I've read them. I don't really know.
I just didn't like it.
I'm just prioritizing reading stuff by like not white men.
Yeah.
That's like,
we got no white men on this show.
None so far. Unless, maybe Adam Silvera. Yeah, no, but true. We haven't. No, we just read that. We didn't do a Minnesota on that or anything.
He's Puerto Rican.
Oh, hey.
Yeah. So we got no white men. Fuck those guys.
That's okay. That's totally fine with me. In my opinion, the pacing didn't work after the first 30 pages.
Agreed.
I loved the first 30 pages. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm here. I'm learning so many things, mainly because of my own ignorance as like a white reader who's never had to like try to be absorbed in a world because things were easy for me because you just default to like white centric worlds. So loved the first 30 pages. And then the pacing for me was too slow in some places, like you mentioned, but then like really frenetic in other places. So I guess it made it hard for me to be like suspended in that plot tension that I get in a lot of, and that can be really successful in making the reader want to keep turning pages.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I wonder if the author does that on purpose so that we kind of feel how Lei is feeling. Like in the beginning, everything is like a little out of control and things are moving really fast. And then time kind of slows down a bit when she, like in the middle of the book, and then everything is more than out of control at the end. Like everything's moving so fast. Maybe it's meant to make us feel that way.
That's a really generous reading. I appreciate that. I like that.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't, I'm there for that. Like if you're trying to make us feel what the reader or the,
like the monotony of
feeling,
paper girl life, basically.
Yeah. They're doing the same thing every day. And I'm like annoyed with like the descriptions of the same things over and over again, as Lei is also annoyed with the doing the same things over and over again. But as a reader, I do get annoyed by that because I'm like, I don't want to be bored in the middle. I will stop reading this book.
But we podcast, so
so we can't.
We persevered.
Yeah.
This kind of goes off of what I just said, but I struggled to suspend my disbelief about a number of things as they seemed thrown in kind of haphazardly. Like Lei all of a sudden being like a super brave warrior person and being willing to commit murder after like 2 weeks of sparring in the woods for an hour a night. That, I mean, I love a montage scene. Don't get me wrong. Like I fucking love that shit. Like in any movie, in any show, like I eat that up. But that was just kind of like seemed unbelievable. And I know that's a ridiculous criticism because it's a fantasy story and technically it's all unbelievable. But there is like at the end, I was like, don't tell me there's going to be a bird to get them out of here. And there was a bird.
And all I could think of was Lord of the Rings.
Oh my God, totally. I didn't even think about that. But I was like, am I really being introduced to an owl demon right now? He's going to fly them out, isn't he? Of course, the shamans don't have like a net or a dome over the palace because that would just be too smart. And if there are other demons that can fly, how did they not think that that was a thing that they should be making over right. the palace? And then that was, so the owl thing was like a deus ex machina for me, just trying to resolve that because they needed to get him out and the book needed to finish.
Right.
And then the owl did the same five moves during the chase scene and it threw off the like elite fighting squad every time. Like, what?
Yeah. I'm realizing now as we're talking about it that the book was really cinematic, like cinematically derivative, in that like I can imagine this as a movie, like as we're watching and seeing things, like I can see everything laid out.
It would be a gorgeous film.
Yeah. But I don't really want that in my books. Like, I don't want it to feel like I'm watching a movie. Like, I know it does kind of like I'm watching a movie in my head, but I don't need I can fill in some of the gaps. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's part of the reader participating in imagining the world.
Right.
But it is easier to do that if you're relying on cultural right. shorthand of like a medieval Europe derived right. fantasy world, which this author isn't for right. good reason.
Yeah, I'm glad she didn't.
Right.
But now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, I could see this as a movie, like, because we get kind of like those time jumps where all of a sudden Leia's been there for like 4 months and she's like, oh, I've been here for 4 months. And I'll see like 4 months later come up across the screen.
There could be like 12 montage scenes in this movie. I would be here for it. I love montage scenes. Makeover scenes.
I do love a makeover scene. I don't like a montage like fight scene because I can like imagine the music they're going to play already. Like, I'm like, please don't do it.
I'm thinking of like 80s music from The Karate Kid.
Yeah, me too. I was really glad we got a character who was actually willing to kill the villain for once. I know I'm always like, just kill them, just kill them, just kill them.
Jessie's the bloodthirsty one on this podcast.
I am. They killed her dog. Like,
oh yeah, if anyone... Well, when you put it in those terms, I'm there for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. And I know at the end, it turns out the king's not dead, which I was not very appreciative of. I was why? Another, like, so tropey.
Por favor, another twist.
Yeah. But I was real glad that Leia was like, let me kill this motherfucker. Like, I was glad.
She's like, she didn't agonize over it. Like, does this then make me a bad person?
Because it doesn't. He's literally committing genocide. He is... like, obviously mentally unstable. Like, something is wrong.
Which doesn't mean that you should kill them. But, like...
No.
Jesse.
No, of course not. But, like, people in charge, like... I don't know. Something... There was... Because she kept talking about, like, he would have, like, these glazed over eyes. And she was blaming it on drinking. But I'm not really sure that's what that was. Like...
I mean, he's just, like, a rapist and an abuser. And, yeah. like, a... like totally unrepentant is the
he deserved to die
linchpin in like a genocidal regime that mm-hmm. is super oppressive and like he enslaves young girls for his personal pleasure. Like, no. And so I agree with you that someone who was actually willing to go through with it and also didn't like agonize about it, she was
we
like,
we never see that.
She was like, yeah, this is what needs to be done, of course.
Yeah, I'm gonna do it. I was glad.
She's like, I'm going to step up. But at the same time, like, did they really think that little hairpin was going to get that job done?
Right. That was some bullshit. Like, yeah. Especially because she's like, his skin is like stronger.
Like,
and,
like hide?
Yeah.
Like cowhide, basically.
Which I imagine is hard to, I don't know. I don't want to think about that. But,
I don't either.
But yeah, either way, glad she killed the king. If you want to bring down the patriarchy, kill the king. That's all I'm saying.
Diversity of tactics.
Yeah, I'm here for it.
Totally necessary.
By any means necessary. Recommend if you like stories that take place in another world and are like, there was a lot of world building in this world and I really enjoyed that.
Absolutely. I would agree with that.
I don't have a book to compare it to though.
Which is a shame. There should be more books like this.
Yeah.
I hope that this is the start of way more books like this.
Yeah, if you like books with representation.
Absolutely, it's important to support that.
Yeah, Asian representation, lesbian representation.
Before we end, let's do some real talk, Jesse. What did this make you think about or question or observe about your own self or the world?
I really thought about the pressure that duty to family can put on a young person. We see this with pretty much all the paper girls. They feel like they need to have sex with the king against their will, even though they don't want to keep their family safe and because it's something that's expected of them. I'm not a very family-oriented person, so it's not something that I encounter or feel on a day-to-day basis. So I thought it was cool to see, like I feel like a lot in YA, people are, like, distancing themselves from their parents. Their parents aren't cool. Like, they're kind of like, fuck you, mom and dad. Like, I'm going to do what I want. This was, like, very opposite of that, like, very loving, close families. And I thought that was interesting.
Absolutely. And how those pressures to put on young people is totally unreasonable.
Oh, my gosh,
for people who are, like, specifically Blue's father, who's using his daughter as a political pawn.
Right. Or even Lei and Ren in the same way as Blue. Like,
right.
But Lei is like, I have to protect my family. But you're a child. Like, that's not your responsibility. Like, your family doesn't want you to suffer so that they can, like, be comfortable, I assume, if you come from a good family. So I can't imagine being in that place where you feel like you need to, like, take care of your family as a young person.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. What about you?
Reading this book brought into really sharp relief for me how little I know about Asian cultures and traditions. And I mean, like, I should have known that that was one of my, like, places for development. So now this is, like, a good reason for me to do better. And by diversifying more of my reading lists and the things I'm curious about and just, like, taking the time to learn more about it and expand my perspective.
More diversity. Also, read To All the Boys I Loved Before. There's some diversity for you.
Oh, so good.
And it's great. They're doing a sequel for the movie.
Yay! Noah Centineo forever.
He's going to be in it, him and Lana Candor.
Okay, phew.
I know. I was like, whew. I was worried. Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue by Mackenzie Lee. And watch out for the occasional minisode about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on iTunes, Google Play /podcasts, and Stitcher. And if you're feeling, you know, it's the Christmas spirit in the Christmas spirit.
Or the Yule spirit.
Yule spirit. Solstice spirit.
Whatever you celebrate.
Whatever time of year that you happen to be listening to this. If you're feeling nice, you could leave us a review or rate the show. We would really appreciate it. It helps other people find us. JK It's Magic is recorded on land traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native peoples. See you in a fortnight. See you in a fortnight. What? See you in a fortnight. But not really see. More like you'll hear us in a fortnight.
Are we good?
We're good.
In a fortnight.